Director Pravat continued. Why would Lord Rawl put our children at such great peril? For his greed, the man shouted in answer to his own question. For his greed! Kalin put a comforting hand on Richard's shoulder. He felt little comfort. He was watching all his work being consumed by the heat from the flames of lies. Dear Creator, Director Pravat called out, lifting his clasped hands to the sky. We give thanks for our new sovereign, a man of peerless talent and unrivaled devotion, the most ethical sovereign ever to reign over us. Please, dear Creator, give him strength against the wicked ways of Lord Rawl. Director Pravat spread his arms. I ask you, good people, to consider this man from afar, a man who took the Mother Confessor of all the Midlands to be his wife. The crowd grumbled in growing displeasure. The Mother Confessor, after all, was their Mother Confessor. Yet this man who shouts for all to hear of his moral leadership, of his desire for what is right, already has another wife. Wherever he goes, he takes her, too, fat with his child. Yet, as this other wife still carries his unborn child, he marries the Mother Confessor and drags her with him, too, as his concubine. How many more women will this sinful man take to sire his wicked offspring? How many bastard children has he created here in Andorith? How many of our women have fallen to his boundless lust? The crowd was genuinely shocked. Besides the moral implications, this was a disgrace to the Mother Confessor. This other woman proudly admits being Lord Rawl's wife, and further confirms it to be his child. What kind of man is this? Lady Chanbor was so shocked by this uncivilized conduct, she took to her bed weeping to recover her senses. The sovereign is beside himself with a scandal of such behavior being brought into Andorith. They both ask that you reject this rutting pig from Dahara. Du Chaillu pulled on Richard's sleeve. This is not true. I will go explain it to them, so they may see it is not evil, as this man says. I will explain it. Richard put a restraining hand on her. You're doing no such thing. These people wouldn't listen. Gian spoke in heated words. Our spirit woman is not a woman who would be immoral. She must explain that she has acted by the law. Gian, Helen said. Richard and I know the truth. You and Du Chaillu and the others with you, you all know the truth. That is what matters. These people have no ears for the truth. This is how tyrants win the will of the people, with lies. Having seen enough, Richard was about to turn to go when a bright orange whoosh of fire erupted out in the crowd. A candle, presumably, ignited a girl's dress. She let out a piercing scream. Her hair caught fire. By the speed of the fire, Richard realized it was no accident. The chimes were among them. Not far away, a man's clothes caught flame. The crowd went into a terrible fright, screaming in fear that Lord Rawl was using magic against them. It was a frightening, sickening sight, seeing the girl and the man flailing as crackling flames raced up their clothes, the sizzling fire catching as if they had been dunked in pitch, as if the fire were a thing alive. The crowd scattered in panic, knocking old and young sprawling. Parents tried to cover the burning girl with a shirt to put out the fire, but it too ignited, adding fuel to the conflagration. The burning man crumbled to the ground. He was little more than a dark stick figure in the center of an intense yellow-orange blaze. As if the good spirits themselves could no longer stand it, the skies opened up in a downpour. The roar of the rain, drumming the dry ground, covered the roar of the fire and the shouts and cries of the people. Darkness descended as the candles were extinguished by the rain. In the square, two fires continued to burn, the girl and the man. The chimes danced over their flesh in liquid light. There was nothing to be done for the two souls lost. If Richard didn't do something, there would be nothing to be done for anyone. The chimes would consume the world of life. Kalin pulled Richard away. It required little effort. They ran back through the darkness and rain and gathered up their horses and the rest of the men. Richard, leading his horse by the reins, guided them to a side route through Fairfield. The reports were accurate, Richard said as he leaned toward Kalin. It's clear these people have been turned against us. Fortunately, the vote is only a few days off, Kalin answered back through the din of rain. We may lose some people here, but at least we have a chance with the rest of Andorith. As they walked their horses through the rain, Richard moved the reins to his other hand and put an arm around Kalin's shoulder. Truth will win out. Kalin didn't answer. The important thing is the chimes, Dushilu said. She looked both saddened and frightened. Whatever else happens, the chimes must be stopped. I do not want to die again by them. I do not want our child to die by them. Whatever happens here, this is only one place. The chimes, though, are everywhere. I do not want to bring my baby into a world with the chimes. There will be no safe place if they are not stopped. That is your true job, Kaharin. Richard put his arm around her shoulders. I know. Maybe I can find the thing I need in the library at the estate. The minister and sovereign have taken the other side, Kalin said. They may not be interested in allowing us to use the library any longer. We're using it, Richard said, one way or another. He guided them down a street that paralleled the main avenue, a street that once out of the city would turn to join into the main road toward the minister's estate. It was on that road, closer to the estate, that their troops were stationed. Richard noticed Kalin staring off at something. He followed her gaze in the rain and darkness to a small sign visible in the lamplight coming from a window beneath it. The sign offered herbs for sale and the services of a midwife. Dushilu was huge. Richard supposed that she must be near to having her baby, whether she wanted it to be born into such a world or not. Chapter 61 It had been a long day, the last hour of it spent slogging through the drenching downpour to where the remainder of their troops were stationed. Well over half of them had been sent off around Andorath to oversee the upcoming vote. Feeling ill, Dushilu was in no condition to ride. It was a miserable walk, and exhaustion finally claimed her, not something she would have admitted lightly. Richard and Gian took turns carrying her the remaining distance. Richard was thankful for the rain for one reason, though. It had cooled the tempers of the throng in Fairfield and sent them home. Ordinarily, Richard would have insisted that Dushilu go straight off to her own tent, but after the events in Fairfield, he understood her gloomy mood and realized she needed their company more than she needed rest. Kalin must have understood, too, or rather than chasing the spirit woman from their tent, as she had had to do on more than one occasion, she gave her a dried taffa biscuit to suck on, saying it would settle her stomach. Kalin sat Dushilu down on the padded blanket that was the bed and with a towel dried her face and hair, while Gian went to get her some dry clothes. Richard sat at the small folding table he used to write messages, orders, and letters, mostly to General Rybish. After having been to the city, he desperately wanted to write the general and order him into Andorath. From outside the tent, a muffled voice asked permission to enter. When Richard granted it, Captain Myford lifted back the heavy flap, propping it up with a pole to act as a little roof to keep the rain from their doorway. He shook himself as best he could under the small roof before stepping inside. Captain, Richard said, I would like to compliment you and your men on the reports. They have been dead accurate about what's going on in Fairfield. The spirits know I wish I could yell at you and dismiss the messengers for getting it wrong or embellishing the facts, but I can't. They were only too right. Captain Myford didn't look pleased to have gotten it right. The situation was nothing to be pleased about. With a finger, he wiped his wet, blonde hair across his forehead. Lord Rawl, I believe we should now bring General Rybish's army south into Andorath. The situation is growing more tenuous by the day. I have a fistful of reports about special Andor guard troops. They are reported to be not at all like the regular Andorath army we have seen. I agree with the captain, Kalin said from the ground beside Dushilu. We need to be in the library, trying to find something of use against the chimes. We don't have time to counter the things being said to sway people to reject us. That's just here, Richard said. Are you so sure? What if it's not? Besides, as I said, we don't have the luxury of time to devote to it. We have more important things to worry about. The Mother Confessor is right, Captain Myford insisted. I have to believe truth will win out. Otherwise, what is there left to do? Lie to people to get them to join our side? It seems to be working for those who oppose us, Kalin pointed out. Richard wiped his wet hair back from his forehead. Look, there's nothing I would like better than to simply call General Rybish down here. Really, there isn't, but we can't. Captain Myford wiped water from his chin. The man seemed to have anticipated the reason for Richard's reluctance and was ready with the reply. Lord Rawl, we have enough men here. We can send word to the general, and before he comes into sight, we can take the Dominie Dirch from the Andrith Army and safely let our men through. I've run that very thought through my mind 1,000 times, Richard said. One thing keeps ringing a warning in my head. What's that? Keelan asked. Richard turned sideways on his small folding stool so he might speak to her as well as the captain. We don't know for sure how the Dominie Dirch work. So we ask someone here, Keelan said. It's not a weapon they use. We can't count on their expertise. Yes, they know that if they're being attacked, they ring the things and the enemy will be killed. Lord Rawl, we have 1,000 men. Once they all return from watching the vote, we can take the Dominie Dirch in a wide swath, and General Rybish will be able to safely bring his army through. Then we can use his men to take the rest all along the frontier, and the Imperial Order will not be able to get through. Perhaps they will even approach, thinking they will be able to pass, and then we will have the opportunity to use the Dominie Dirch against them. Richard turned the candle on the table round and round in his fingers as he listened, and then in the silence that followed. There's one problem with that, he said at last. And that is what I've already said. We aren't sure how they work. We know the basics of the things, Keelan said, her frustration growing. But the problem is, Richard said, that we don't know enough. First of all, we can't take all the Dominie Dirch all along the frontier. There are too many. They run along the entire border. We could only take some, like you suggested, Captain. Therein lies the problem. Remember when we came through? How those people were killed when the Dominie Dirch rang? Yes, but we don't know why they rang, Keelan said. Besides, what difference does that make? What if we capture a stretch of the Dominie Dirch, Richard said, looking back and forth between Keelan and Captain Myford, and then tell General Rybish it's safe to bring his army in? What if, when all those men are just about there, Andereth soldiers somewhere else, one still in control of the Dominie Dirch, ring theirs? So what? Keelan asked. They will be too far away. Are you sure? Richard leaned toward her for emphasis. What if that rings them all? What if they know how to ring the entire line? Remember when we came in how they said they all rang and everyone out in front of the Dominie Dirch was killed? They all rang together, as one. But they didn't know why they all rang, Keelan said. The soldiers didn't ring them. How do you know that one person somewhere along that entire line didn't ring their Dominie Dirch and caused them all to ring? Maybe accidentally, and they're too afraid to admit it for fear of their punishment. Or perhaps one of those young people stationed there out of boredom just wanted to try it. What if the same thing happens while our army is out there before those murderous things? Can you imagine? General Rybish has near to 100,000 men, maybe more by now. Can you imagine his entire force killed in one instant? Richard looked from Kalin's calm face to the captain's alarmed expression. Our entire army down here in the south, at once, dead. Imagine it. But I don't think, Keelan began. And are you willing to risk the lives of all those young men on what you think? Are you so sure? I don't know that the Dominie Dirch work together like that, but what if they do? Maybe one rung in anger rings them all. Can you say it won't? I'm not willing to put the innocent lives of those brave men to such a deadly gamble, are you? Richard looked back to Captain Myford. Are you? Are you a gambler, Captain? Could you so easily wager the lives of all those men? He shook his head. If it was my own life, Lord Rawl, I would willingly risk it. But not for all those lives. The roar eased up as the rain slowed a little. Men went by outside the opening of the tent, taking feed to the horses. For the most part, the camp sat in pitch blackness. Fires were forbidden except where essential. I can't disagree with that. Keelan lifted her hands and then, in frustration, let them drop back into her lap. But Jagang is coming. If we don't win the people to our cause so they will stand against him, he will take Andereth. He will be invincible behind the Dominie Dirch and be able to stab into the Midlands at will and bleed us to death. Richard listened to the rain drumming on the tent roof and splashing outside the open doorway. It sounded like the kind of steady rain that was going to be with them for the night. Richard spoke softly. As I see it, we have only one option. We must go back to the library at the estate and see if we can find anything useful. We haven't yet, Keelan said. And with the people in charge now taking a stand against us, Captain Myford said, they might resist that. Richard made a fist on the table as he met the man's blue-eyed gaze. Richard once again wished he had the sword of truth with him. if they resist, Captain. Then you and your men will be called upon to do what you constantly train for. They resist, and if we have to, we'll cut down anyone who lifts a finger to oppose us, and then we'll level the place. We just need to get the books out of there first. Relief eased the expression on the man's face. The Daharans seemed to harbor a fear that Richard might be unwilling to act. Captain Myford looked assuaged to hear otherwise. Yes, Lord Rawl. The men will be ready in the morning when you are. Kalin's point about there possibly being nothing of value at the estate was worrisome. Richard remembered the books in the library. While he couldn't recall the details of the information, he remembered the subjects well enough to know that finding the answer was a long shot. Still, it was the only shot they had. Before I go, Captain Myford pulled a paper from his pocket. I thought you should know a number of people have requested an audience when you have time, Lord Rawl. Most of them were merchants wanting information. Thank you, Captain, but I don't have time now. I understand, Lord Rawl. I took the liberty of telling them as much. He shuffled his little notes. There was one woman. He squinted in the dim candlelight to make out the name. Franca Gowanlock. She said it was extremely urgent, but would give no information. She was here most of the day. She finally said she had to return to her home, but she would be back tomorrow. If it's important, she'll be back and I'll talk to her. Richard looked down at Duchaloux to see how she was feeling. She looked comforted by Kalin's care. Behind him rose a sudden commotion. Captain pitched backward with a cry as if felled by magic. The candle flame fluttered wildly at the intrusion of a wind, but stayed lit. Richard spun to the sound of a dull thump. The candle wobbled across the top of the shuddering table, right up to the edge. A huge raven had crashed sprawling onto the tabletop. Richard scooted back in surprise, drawing his sword as he stood, wishing again that it were the Sword of Truth with its attendant magic. Kalin and Duchaloux shot to their feet. The raven had something black in its big beak. With all the confusion, the wind, the candle nearly toppling, the flame fluttering, the table teetering, and the tent sides flapping, he didn't immediately recognize the object in the raven's beak. The raven set it on the table. The inky black bird, water beaded on glossy feathers like the night itself, come into their tent, looked exhausted. The way it lay sprawled on the table with its wings open, Richard didn't think it was well, or possibly it was injured. Richard didn't know if a thing possessed of the chimes could really be injured. He recalled the chicken that wasn't a chicken bleeding. He saw a smear of blood on the tabletop. Whenever that chime in a chicken had been around, even if he couldn't see it, the hairs at the back of Richard's neck had stood up. Yet with this raven that wasn't a raven right before him on the table, he hadn't reacted that way. The raven cocked its head, looking Richard in the eye. It was as deliberate a look as he'd ever gotten. With its beak, the bird tapped the center of the thing it had laid on the table. Captain Myford sprang up then and swung his sword. At the same time, Richard flung up his arms, shouting, "No!" The raven, as the sword came down, hurled itself off the table onto the ground and ran between the captain's legs. Once past the man, it took wing and was gone. "Sorry," Captain said. I thought it was attacking you with magic, Lord Rawl. I thought it was a thing of dark magic come to attack you." Richard let out a deep breath as he gestured forgiveness to the man. The man was only trying to protect him. "It was not evil," Duchaloux said in a soft voice, as she and Kalin came closer. Richard sank back down on his stool. "No, it wasn't." Kalin and Duchaloux stood over his shoulder looking. "What omen did the messenger from the spirits bring you?" the spirit woman asked. "I don't think it was from the spirit world," Richard said. He picked up the small, flat object. In the dim light, he suddenly realized what it was. He stared incredulously. It was just like the one Sister Verna used to carry. He had seen her use it countless times. "It's a journey book." He opened the cover. "That has to be High Daharan," Kalin said of the strange script. "Dear spirits," Richard breathed as he read the only two words on the first page. "What?" Kalin asked. "What is it? What does it say?" "Fuer Berglindersh." "You're right. It's High Daharan. Do you know the meaning?" "It says, the mountain." Richard turned and peered up at her in the flickering candlelight. "That was Joseph Anders' cognomen. This is Joseph Anders' journey book. The other, the one that was destroyed, its twin, was called Mountain's Twin." Chapter 62. Dalton smiled as he stood at an octagonal table of rare black walnut in the reliquary in the Office of Cultural Amity, where displayed on the walls around the room were objects belonging to past directors, robes, small tools, implements of their profession, such as pens and beautifully carved blotters, and writings. Dalton was looking over more modern writings, reports he had requested from the directors. Any ambivalence the directors might feel, they kept to themselves. Publicly, they now threw themselves into the task of supporting the new sovereign. It had been made plain to them that their very existence now depended not only upon their fealty, but upon their enthusiasm in that devotion. As he read the script of addresses they were to deliver, Dalton was annoyed by shouts coming in through an open window overlooking the city square. It sounded like an angry mob of people. Judging by the boisterous encouragement from the crowd, he assumed it was someone delivering a diatribe against Lord Rawl and the Mother Confessor. Following the lead of noted people such as the directors, ordinary people had now taken to loudly voicing the tailored notions they had been fed. Even though Dalton had expected it, he never failed to find it remarkable the way he had but to say a thing enough times through enough people, and it became the popular truth, its provenance lost as it was mimicked by ordinary people who came to believe that it was their own idea, as if original thought routinely came forth from their witless minds of clay. Dalton let out a bitter snort of contempt. They were asses and deserved the fate they embraced. They belonged to the Imperial Order now, or at least they soon would. He glanced out the window to see a throng making its way into the city square. The heavy rain of the night before had turned to a light drizzle, so people were coming back out. The steady downpour overnight failed to wash away the blackened places on the cobble paving in the square where the two people had burned to death. The crowd, of course, blamed the tragedy on the magic of Lord Rawl, venting his wrath against them. Dalton had instructed his people to bitterly make the accusation, knowing the seriousness of the charge would outweigh the lack of evidence, much less the truth. What had really happened, Dalton didn't know. He did know this was far from the first such incident. Whatever it was an appalling misfortune. But if misfortune was to happen, it could have hardly picked a better time. It had punctuated Director Pravat's speech perfectly. Dalton wondered if the fires had anything to do with what Franca had told him about magic failing. He didn't see how, but he didn't think she had told him everything either. The woman had been behaving quite oddly of late. At the knock, Dalton turned to the door. Rowley bowed. "What is it?"
"Minister," Rowley said. "The woman is here, the one Emperor Jigang sent."
"Where is she?"
"Down the hall. She is having tea."
Dalton shifted his scabbard at his hip. This was not a woman to trifle with. She was said to have more power than any ordinary such woman, more power even than Franca. Jigang had assured him, though, that unlike Franca, this woman still had firm control of her power. "Take her to the estate. Give her one of our finest rooms. If she gives you any..." Dalton recalled Franca's talent for overhearing things. "If she gives you any complaints, see to resolving them to her satisfaction. She is a most important guest and is to be treated as such." Rowley bowed.
"Yes, Minister."
Dalton saw Rowley smile with one side of his mouth. He, too, knew why the woman was there. Rowley was looking forward to it. Dalton just wanted it done with. It would require care. They had to wait and pick their own time. They couldn't force it, or the whole thing could come undone. If they handled it right, though, it would be a great accomplishment. Jigang would be more than grateful.
"I appreciate your generosity."
Dalton turned at the sound of a woman's voice. She had stepped into the doorway. Rowley backed out of her way. She looked middle-aged, with gray hair mixing in with the black. Her simple, dowdy, dark blue dress ran from her neck over her rather thick-boned shape and all the way to the floor. Her presence was dominated by a smile that only vaguely touched her lips, but was ever so evident in her brown eyes. It was as nasty a simper as Dalton had ever seen. It unashamedly proclaimed a mien of superiority. Because of the lines at the corners of her mouth and eyes, the self-satisfied smirk seemed enduringly etched on her face. A gold ring pierced her lower lip. "And you would be?" he asked.
"Sister Penthia, here to wield my talent in the service to His Excellency Emperor Jigang."
Her smooth flow of words was laced with crystalline frost. Dalton bowed his head. "Minister of Culture Dalton Campbell, thank you for coming, Sister Penthia.
We are most appreciative of your courtesy in lending your unique assistance. She had been sent to wield her talent in service to Dalton Campbell, but he thought better of putting too fine a point on it. Dalton didn't need to remind her she was the one with a ring through her lip. It was obvious to them both. At the sound of screams, Dalton again glanced across the room, out the window, thinking it was the parents or family returned to see the sight of the grisly deaths the night before. People had been coming by all morning, leaving flowers or other offerings at the site of the deaths, until they looked like a grotesque garden midden. Frequent wails of anguish rose up into the gray day. Sister Penthea turned his attention to business. "I need to see the ones chosen for the deed," Dalton motioned with a hand. "Rowley there, he will be one of them." Without word or warning, she slapped the palm of her hand to Rowley's forehead. Her fingers splayed into his red hair, grasping his head as if she might pluck it like a ripe pear. Rowley's eyes rolled back in his head. His entire body began to tremble. The sister murmured thick words that had no meaning to Dalton. Each, as it oozed forth, seemed to take root in Rowley. The young man's arms flinched when she stressed particular words. With the last phrase raising in intonation, she gave Rowley's head a sharp shove. Letting out a small cry, Rowley crumpled as if his bones had dissolved. In a moment, he sat up and shook his head. A smile told Dalton he was fine. He brushed clean his dark brown trousers as he stood, looking no different despite his added lethality. "The others?" she asked. Dalton gestured dismissively. "Rowley can take you to them." She bowed slightly. "Good day then, Minister. I will see to it immediately. The Emperor also wishes me to express his pleasure at being able to be of assistance. Either way, muscle or magic, the Mother Confessor's fate is now sealed." She wheeled around and stormed away, Rowley following in her wake. Dalton couldn't say he was sorry to see her go. Before he could return to reading his reports in earnest, he again heard the cheering. The sight when he lifted his head to look out the window was unexpected. Someone was being dragged into the square, a mob of people following behind as the people already in the square parted to make way, cheering on those entering, some of whom carried scraps of crates, tree branches, and sheafs of straw. Dalton went to the window and leaned on the sill with both hands as he peered down at the sight. It was Saren Rajak, at the head of a few hundred of his followers all dressed in white robes. When he saw who they had, who they were dragging into the square, who was screaming, Dalton gasped aloud. His heart pounding with dread, he stared out the window, wondering what he could do. He had guards with him, real guards, not Andorath army soldiers, but 24 men. He realized it was a futile thought, even as he had it. Armed though they were, they stood no chance against the thousands in the square. Dalton knew better than to stand before a crowd intent on violence. That was only a good way to have the violence turned your way. Despite his feelings, Dalton dared not side against the people in this. Among the men with Saren Rajak, in among the man's followers, Dalton saw one in a dark uniform. Stein. With icy dread, Dalton realized the reason Stein was there and what he wanted. Dalton backed away from the window. He was no stranger to violence, but this was an atrocity. At last, he ran back into the corridor that echoed his footfalls, descended the steps, and raced down the hall. He didn't know what to do, but if there was anything... He reached the entry set behind fluted stone columns outside the building, at the top of the cascade of steps. He halted well back in the shadows of the interior, assessing the situation. Outside, on the landing, partway down the steps, guards patrolled to keep people from thoughts of coming up into the Office of Cultural Amity. It was a symbolic gesture. This many people would easily sweep aside the guards. Dalton dared not give people in such a foul mood a reason to turn their anger to him. A woman, holding the hand of a young boy, pulled him along as she pushed her way to the front of the crowd.
"I am Nora," she proclaimed to the people. "This is my son Bruce. He's all I got left because of witches. My husband Julian was drowned because of a dark curse from a witch. My beautiful daughter Bethany was burned up alive by a witch's spell."
The boy Bruce wept, mumbling it was true, wept for his father and sister. Saren Rajak held up the woman's arm.
"Here is a victim of the Keeper's witchcraft." He pointed to a wailing woman near the front. "There is another. Many of you here have been harmed by curses and hexes from witches, witches using evil from the Keeper of the Dead."
With the crowd in this ugly a mood, Dalton knew this could come to no good end.
but he could think of nothing to do to stop it. It was, after all, the reason he had released Saren Rajak, to rouse anger against magic. He needed people to be stirred up against those with magic, to see them as evil. Who better than a zealot to foment such hatred?
And here is the witch.
Saren Rajak thrust his arm out to point at the woman whose hands were bound behind her, the woman Stein held by the hair.
She is the Keeper's vile tool. She casts evil spells to harm you all.
The mob was yelling and screaming for vengeance.
What should we do with this witch?
Rajak shrieked.
Burn her, burn her, burn her, came the chant.
Saren Rajak flung his arms toward the sky.
Dear Creator, we commend this woman to your care in the flames. If she be innocent, spare her harm. If she be guilty of the crime of witchcraft, burn her.
As men threw up a pole, Stein bore his captive face down to the ground. He pulled her head up by her hair. With his other hand, he brought up his knife. Dalton, his eyes wide, was unable to blink, to breathe as he watched Stein slice from one ear to the other across the top of Franka's forehead. Her scream ripped Dalton's insides as Stein ripped back her scalp. Tears ran down Dalton's cheeks as blood ran down Franka's face. Shrieking in pain and immeasurable terror, she was lifted and bound to the pole. The whites of her eyes stood out from a mask of blood. Franka didn't argue for her innocence or beg for her life. She just screamed in paralyzed horror. Straw and wood were thrown up around her. The mob pressed in, wanting to be close to see it all. Some reached out and stole a swipe at the blood coursing down her face, eager for a memento of witch's blood on their fingertips to prove their power before they sent her to the Keeper. Horror dragging him by his throat, Dalton staggered partway down the steps. Men with torches pushed through to the front of the roaring mob. Saren Rajak, wild with rage, climbed the clutter of wood and straw at her feet to shout in Franka's face, to call her every sort of vile name and accuse her of every sort of evil crime. Dalton, standing helpless on the steps, knew all the words to be false. Franka was not one of those things. Just then, a most extraordinary thing happened. A raven swooped down from the gray sky, fixing its angry claws in Saren Rajak's hair. Saren screamed that it was the witch's familiar, come to protect its mistress. The crowd responded by throwing things at the bird, while at the same time Saren tried to fight it off. The bird flapped and squawked, but held on to the man's hair. With such frightening determination that Dalton began to think that the charges it was the witch's familiar seemed true, the huge inky black bird used its beak to stab out Saren's good eye. The man screamed in pain and rage as he fell from the tinder around Franka. As he did, the mob heaved on the torches. A wail, such as Dalton had never heard, rose from poor Franka as the flames exploded through the dry straw and up the length of her. Even from where he stood, Dalton could smell the burning flesh. And then, in her terror, in her pain, in her burning death, Franka turned her head and saw Dalton standing there on the steps. She screamed his name. Over the roar of the crowd, he couldn't hear it, but he could read it on her lips. She screamed it again, and screamed she loved him. When Dalton read those words on her lips, they crushed his heart. The flames blistered her flesh, till the scream pushed from her lungs sounded like the shriek of the lost souls in the world of the dead. Dalton stood numb, watching it, realizing only then that his hands were holding his head, and he was screaming too. The crowd surged forward, eager to smell the roasting flesh, to see the witch's skin burn. They were wild with excitement, their eyes mad with it. As the mob pressed in, the ones in front were pushed so close it singed off their eyebrows, and this too they relished, as the witch screamed and burned. On the ground, the raven was pecking wildly at the blinded, almost forgotten Saren Rajak. He swung his arms, unseeing, trying to get the vengeful bird away. Darting in between his flailing arms, the raven's big beak snatched, twisted, and tore chunks of flesh from his face. The crowd began pelting the bird anew with anything handy. The bird, finally looking as if it was losing strength, flapped helplessly as everything from shoes to flaming branches arced through the air toward it. For reasons he didn't understand, Dalton, weeping, found himself cheering the bird against all odds, knowing it too was about to die. Just as it looked as if the end was near for the valiant, avenging raven, a riderless horse charged into the square. Blocked by the mob, it reared wildly, knocking people aside. It spun and kicked, injuring people, snapping bones, breaking heads. People fell back as the golden chestnut-colored horse, ears pinned back, snorting with an angry scream, charged into the center of the crowd. Frightened people, trying to fall back, were unable to make way for the press of other people behind them. The horse, seeming to have gone insane with anger, trampled anyone in its way to get to the center of the square. Dalton had never heard of a horse running toward a fire. As it reached the middle of the melee, the raven, with a last desperate effort, flapped its great black wings and made it up onto the horse's back. When the horse wheeled, Dalton thought for a moment that it had another bird on it, as if there were two black ravens, but then he realized the second was just a splotch of black color on the horse's rump. With the raven's claws clutching the horse's mane just above the withers, the horse reared up one last time before coming down and charging off in a dead run. The people who could leaped out of the way. Those unable to do so were trampled by the enraged beast. Alone on the steps, Franca's screams thankfully ended. Dalton saluted the golden chestnut mare and avenging raven as they fled at a full gallop from the city center. Chapter 63 Bieta squinted out over the plains in the dawn light. It was good to see that the sun was going to shine once it reached the horizon. The rain of the last few days had been wearing. Now there were only a few dark purple clouds, like a child's charcoal scribbles, across the golden eastern sky. From up on the stone base of the Domini Dirch, beneath that immense sweep of sky overhead, she could see forever, it seemed, out onto the vast plains of the wilds. Bieta saw that Estelle Ruffin was right in calling her up top. In the distance, a rider was coming. He was taking the dry ground right toward them. The rider was still a goodly distance, but by the way he was running his horse, he didn't look like he intended to stop. Bieta waited until he was a little closer, and then cupped her hands around her mouth and yelled, "Halt! Halt where you are!" Still, he came on. He was probably still too far away to hear her. The plains were deceptive. Sometimes it took a rider much longer to reach them than it seemed it should. "What should we do?" Estelle asked, having never had a rider approach so fast before, looking like he didn't intend to stop. Bieta was finally used to Anders relying on her and asking her for instructions. She was not only getting used to her authority, she had come to delight in it. It was ironic. Bertrand Chanbur had made the laws that enabled Bieta to join the army and command Anders, and Bertrand Chanbur had caused her to avail herself of the laws. She hated him, and at the same time he was her unwitting benefactor. Now that he was sovereign, she tried, as was her duty and hard as it was, to feel only love for him. Just the night before, Captain Tolbert had come by with some Daharan soldiers. They were riding down the line of Domini Dirch to take the votes of the squads stationed at each weapon. They'd all talked about it, and though Bieta didn't see their votes, she knew her squad all marked an X. Bieta had a strong feeling about Lord Rawl, having met and talked to him, that he was a good man. The mother confessor, too, seemed much kinder than Bieta had expected. Still, Bieta and her squad were proud to be in the Andorath army, the best army in the world, Captain Tolbert told them, an army undefeated since the creation of the land and invincible now. Bieta had responsibility. She was a soldier who commanded respect. Now, just as Bertrand Chanbor's law said, she didn't want anything to change. Even though it was for Bertrand Chanbur, their new sovereign, and against Lord Rawl, Bieta had proudly marked an X. Emmeline had her hand on the striker, and Carl stood close to it too, anticipating Bieta ordering it out. Bieta instead motioned the two away from the thing. "There's only one rider," Bieta said in a calm voice of authority, settling their nerves. Estelle heaved a sigh in frustration. "But, Sergeant, we are trained soldiers. One man is no threat. We know how to fight. We've been trained in combat." Carl shifted his sword on his weapons belt, eager for the responsibility of doing some real soldiering. Bieta snapped her fingers, pointing to the steps. "Go, Carl. Get Norris and Annette. The three of you meet me down at the front line. Emmeline, you stay up here with Estelle, but I want both of you to stand away from the striker. I'll not have you ringing this weapon for no more threat than a lone rider. We'll handle it. Just stay at your post and keep watch." Both women saluted with a hand to their brow. Carl did a quick version before he raced down the steps, breathless with the possibility of real action. Bieta straightened her sword at her hip and went down the steps in a dignified manner more befitting her rank. Bieta stood beside the huge stone weapon at the line, as they called it. beyond the Dominie Dirch would kill. She clasped her hands behind her back as Carl raced up with Norris and Annette. Annette was still putting on her chainmail. Beata finally understood the shouts coming from the rider racing toward them. He was screaming for them not to ring the Dominie Dirch. Beata thought she recognized the voice. Carl had his hand on the hilt of his sword. "Sergeant?" She nodded, and the two men and one woman drew steel. It was the first time they'd done so for a potential threat. All three were beaming with the thrill of it. Beata cupped her hands around her mouth again.
"Halt!"
This time the rider heard her. He hauled back on the reins and drew his lathered horse to a stumbling, clumsy halt a little distance out. Beata's jaw dropped.
"Fitch!"
He grinned.
"Beata, is that you?"
He dismounted and walked his horse toward her. The horse looked in sorry shape. Fitch didn't look much better, but he still managed to swagger.
"Fitch," Beata growled, "get over here."
Disappointed that Beata knew the man and there didn't look like there was going to be any swordplay, Carl, Norris, and Annette returned their weapons to their scabbards. They all stared openly, though, at the weapon Fitch was wearing. It was held on with a baldric running over the right shoulder opposite the sword and scabbard at his left hip, thereby helping balance the weight. The leather of the baldric was finely tooled and looked old. Beata knew leatherwork and hadn't seen anything that fine. The scabbard was embellished with simply peerless silver and gold work. The sword itself was remarkable, what she could see anyway. It had a down-swept, bright-work crossguard. The hilt looked wound in silver wire, with a bit of gold, too, glinting in the early light. Fitch, chest puffed up, smiled at her.
"Good to see you, Beata. I'm glad to see you got the job you were after. I guess both of us got our dream after all."
Beata knew she had earned her dream. Having known Fitch a good long time, she doubted the same of him.
"Fitch, what are you doing here? And what are you doing with that weapon?"
His chin lifted.
"It's mine. I told you that someday I'd be Seeker, and now I am. This here is the sword of truth."
Beata stared down at it. Fitch turned the weapon out a little so she could see the hilt with writing and gold wire. It was the word Fitch had drawn in the dust that one day at the minister's estate. She remembered it. Truth.
"The wizards gave you that?"
Beata pointed, incredulous.
"The wizards named you Seeker of Truth."
"Well," Fitch glanced back over his shoulder out to the wilds.
"It's a long story, Beata."
"Sergeant, Beata," she said, not about to be outdone by the likes of Fitch. He shrugged.
"Sergeant, that's great, Beata."
He glanced over his shoulder again.
Can I talk to you?"
He cast a wary eye to those watching their every word.
"Alone?"
"Fitch,
I don't..." "Please."
He looked worried, like she'd never seen him before. Behind the cocky attitude, he was distraught. Beata took hold of his filthy messenger's jacket at the collar and pulled him along, away from the others. All their eyes followed. Beata guessed she didn't blame them. It was the most interesting thing that had happened since the day the Mother Confessor and Lord Rawl came through.
"What are you doing with that sword? It isn't yours."
Fitch's face took on the familiar pleading expression she knew so well.
"Beata, I had to take it. I had to..."
"You stole it?
You stole the sword of truth?"
"I had to.
You don't..."
"Fitch, you are a thief. I should arrest you and..."
"Well, that would be fine by me.
Then I could prove the charges are false." She frowned.
"What charges?" "That I raped you."
Beata was thunderstruck. She couldn't even say anything.
"I got accused of what the minister and Stein did to you. I need this sword of truth to help me prove the truth, that I didn't do it, that the minister is the one who did it, and he's the sovereign now."
Fitch sagged.
"Then not even this sword will help me. The sovereign? Boy, this is a real mess."
"You've got that right." He seemed to get life back in him. He seized her by her shoulders.
"Beata, you gotta help me. There's a crazy woman after me. Use the Dominie Dirch. Stop her. You can't let her through."
"Why?" "She the one you stole the sword from?"
"Beata, you don't understand.
You stole that sword. But it's me that don't understand. I understand. You're a liar." Fitch sagged.
"Beata, she murdered Morley."
Beata's eyes widened. She knew how big Morley was.
"You mean she has magic or something?"
Fitch looked up.
"Magic? Yes, that must be it. She has magic. Beata, she's crazy. She killed Morley."
"Imagine that. Someone kills a thief, and that makes her a crazy murderer." You are a worthless Haken, Fitz. That's all you are, a worthless Haken who stole a sword that doesn't belong to them, and they never could earn.
Yetta, please, she's going to kill me. Please don't let her through.
Riders coming, Estelle called out. Fitz nearly jumped out of his skin. Beata looked up at Estelle, but saw she was pointing to the rear, not out to the wilds. Beata relaxed a bit.
Who are they? She called up at Estelle.
Can't tell yet, Sergeant.
Fitch, you got to give that thing back. When this woman comes, you have to...
Rider coming, Sergeant!
Emmeline called, pointing out to the wilds.
What'd she look like?
Fitch called up, frantic as a cat with its tail afire. Emmeline looked out to the plains for a minute.
I don't know. She's too far away.
Red?
Fitch called.
Does it look like she's in red?
Emmeline peered off another minute.
Blonde hair, wearing red.
Let her pass, Beata ordered.
Yes, Sergeant.
Fitch threw up his arms, looking suddenly terrified.
Beata, what are you doing? You want to get me killed? She's crazy. The woman is a monster. She's...
We'll have a talk with her. Don't worry. We'll not let the little boy get hurt. We'll find out what she wants and take care of it.